Lydia had spread out some paperwork on the floor. Instead of more private detective reports, Claire was surprised to recognize her father's handiwork. Sam Carroll had devoted an entire wall in his apartment to tracking down leads about Julia. There were photographs and note cards and torn sheets of paper with phone numbers and names scribbled across them. In all, the entire collection took up around 5 by 10 feet of space. He'd lost the deposit for the apartment because of all the holes the thumbtacks had left in the sheetrock. She asked Lydia, "You kept Dad's wall?" "No. It was in the second file box." "Of course it was." Claire knelt down. The wall had defined her father for so many years. His desperation still emanated from every scrap of paper. Vet school had taught him to be a meticulous note-taker. He had recorded everything he'd read or heard or witnessed, combined police reports and statements, until the case was as imprinted on his brain as the structure of a dog's digestive system or the signs of feline leukemia. She picked up a sheet of notebook paper that had her father's handwriting on it. In the last 2 weeks of his life, Sam Carroll had developed a slight palsy after a minor stroke. His suicide note had been barely legible. Claire had forgotten what his original penmanship looked like. She asked Lydia, "What's it called?" "The Palmer Method." Lydia was standing behind Claire. "He was supposed to be left-handed, but they made him use his right hand."
"They did that to me, too."
"They made you wear a mitten so you wouldn't use your left hand. Mom was furious when she found out." Claire sat down on the floor. She couldn't stop touching the only pieces she had left of her father. Sam had handled this picture of a man who talked to another man who had a sister who maybe knew something about Julia. He had touched this matchbook from the Manhattan, the bar where Julia was last seen. He had written notes on this menu from the Grit, her favorite vegetarian restaurant. He had stared at this photograph of Julia leaning against her bike. Claire stared at the photograph, too. A gray, houndstooth fedora was in the handlebar basket. Julia's long blonde hair cascaded around her shoulders in a soft perm. She was wearing a man's black suit jacket and white dress shirt with tons of silver and black bangles on her wrists and white lace gloves on her hands. Because it was the late 1980s, and every girl they knew back then wanted to look like either Cyndi Lauper or Madonna. Claire said, "I want to tell myself that Paul kept all of this because one day he thought I might want to see it." Lydia lowered herself to the floor beside Claire. She pointed to the photo of Julia. "That's my locket she's wearing. It had a cursive L on the front." They both knew that Julia was still wearing the gold locket when she disappeared. Claire said, "She was always stealing your things." Lydia bumped her shoulder.
"You were always stealing mine."
Claire was suddenly struck by a thought. "Did Paul have a file on me?"
"No."
She studied her sister, wondering if Lydia was lying to her for the same reason that Claire was lying to Lydia. Lydia asked, "What about Dad's journals?" Sam had started keeping a diary after Helen left because there was no one left to confide in.
"They weren't in Paul's boxes."
"Maybe Mom has them?" Claire shrugged. She had felt so disconnected from her father at the time of his death that she hadn't asked for any of his belongings. It was only later, when she thought of things like his glasses or his books or his collection of animal-themed ties, that she wished she'd been more present. She told Lydia, "I used to read his journals, probably because he tried to hide them from me, Bonus points to Paul.
She leaned back against the wall.
The last section I read was about 6 months before he died. They were written like letters to Julia. Things that he remembered about her growing up. How we had all changed without her. He didn't act like it, but he was pretty tuned into our lives. He knew exactly what we were up to.
God, I hope not.
He and Mom still got together, even after she remarried.
Lydia nodded.
I know.
Claire saw another photo of Julia that she had forgotten about. She groaned as she got up on her knees to retrieve it. She'd torn her meniscus 5 years ago, and it still felt like it was looking for any excuse to crack back open.
Are your knees as bad as mine?
Not as bad as Allison Hendrickson's.
Fair point. Claire looked down at the picture. Julia was sunning herself on the front lawn in a blue two-piece bathing suit. Her pink skin glistened with baby oil. Lydia was probably behind the camera. They never let Claire sunbathe with them, or go out with them, or breathe near them.
God, look at how red her skin is. She would have had all kinds of skin cancer.
I had a spot removed last year.
Lydia pointed to the side of her nose. Claire was momentarily grateful for being left out.
I bet she would have had tons of kids.
Future young Republicans.
Claire laughed. Julia had feigned a stomach ache so she could stay home from school and watch the Iran-Contra hearings. She would have homeschooled her kids to keep them from being brainwashed by the public education machine.
And made them eat so much soy that their testicles never dropped.
Claire shuffled around some of her father's notes.
Oh, no, she wouldn't have boys. That's giving in to the patriarchy.
Do you think she would have vaccinated?
Claire barked a laugh, because even in 1991, Julia had doubted the veracity of the government-backed pharmaceutical industrial complex.
What's this?
She picked up a stapled stack of papers from the Oconee County Superior Court. Lydia squinted at the document.
I found it in a separate folder. It's a deed for a property in Watkinsville.
Paul had grown up in Watkinsville, which was just outside of Athens. Claire turned to the second page to find the name and address of the legal owner.
Buckminster Fuller, Lydia said, because, of course, she'd already seen it. Why does that name sound familiar?
He was Paul's favorite architect. She handed Lydia the pages because she couldn't look at them anymore. Paul grew up on a farm in Watkinsville. He told me that everything was sold when his parents died.
Lydia stood up from the floor. She retrieved her reading glasses and Claire's iPad from the kitchen island and sat back down beside her.
Claire felt the building wave of nausea that always accompanied uncovering another one of Paul's lies. Lydia slid on her glasses and started to type. Claire stared at the back of the white leather couch. She wanted to rip open the leather with her fingernails. She wanted to break the wood frame, find some matches, and burn down this entire fucking house.
Not that it would burn.
Paul had installed the most comprehensive residential fire suppression system that the county building inspector had ever seen. Lydia said, "The online records only go back 10 years, but Buckminster Fuller's property taxes are up to date." Claire thought about the painting in Paul's office. His childhood home. She had spent hours getting the shadows and angles just right. He had cried when she'd given it to him for their anniversary. She told Lydia,
"Paul said the guy who bought the property tore down the house so he could farm the land."
"Did you ever drive by to look at it?"
"No."
Claire had asked several times. In the end, she had respected his need for privacy.
"Paul said it was too painful."
Lydia went back to work on the iPad. This time, Claire made herself watch. Lydia pulled up Google Earth. She typed in the Watkinsville address.
acres of plowed fields showed on the screen. Lydia zoomed in closer. There was a small house on the property. Claire easily recognized Paul's childhood home. The white wood siding ran up and down instead of across. The barn had been torn down, but there was a car in the driveway and a child's swing set in the large patch of backyard that separated the house from the farmer's field. Lydia said, "There's no street view. The road doesn't even have a name." She asked, "Do you think he's renting it out?" Claire put her head in her hands. She didn't know anything anymore. "There's a phone number." Lydia got up again. She was reaching for her cell phone on the counter when Claire stopped her. "Use the burner phone. It's by the chair in my office." Lydia disappeared down the hallway. Claire stared out at the backyard. The windows were clouded with condensation. Mist was coming off the pool. She would need to have the heater turned down. They rarely used the pool in the winter anyway. Maybe she should have it covered. Or filled in with concrete. The marble coping was a bitch to keep clean. In the summer, the decking got so hot that you had to wear sandals or risk third-degree burns. Paul had designed the pool to be beautiful, not usable. If there was a better metaphor for their lives, Claire didn't know what it was. She picked up the iPad. The satellite image of the Buckminster Fuller homestead had been taken during the summer months. The field behind the house was lush with fruit vines. The small single-story house still had the same white wood siding that Claire had so carefully tried to render in Paul's anniversary painting. Board and batten siding, he had told Claire it was called. Large vertical planks of wood with smaller strips to cover the seams. There were bright green asphalt shingles on the roof. The yard was neatly trimmed. The swing set at the rear of the lot looked sturdy and overbuilt. Two things that Paul always strived for in residential construction. At least Claire knew that Paul hadn't lied about the accident that killed his parents. He didn't like to talk about it, but Claire had heard all of the details from her mother. Despite the 30,000 students attending the University of Georgia, Athens was still a small town, and the main library, like every library in America, was the center of the community. What Helen hadn't read in the newspaper, she'd gleaned from local gossip. The Scotts were driving home from a church function when a tractor trailer hit a patch of ice and jackknifed across the Atlanta highway. Paul's father had been decapitated. His mother had lived for several seconds. At least, that's what bystanders reported. They had heard the woman screaming as the car was engulfed in flames. Paul was terrified of fire. It was the only thing Claire knew of that ever scared him. His burial instructions had specifically stated that he shouldn't be cremated. "What is it?" Lydia asked. She had the burner phone in her hand. "I was just thinking about Paul's burial instructions." They hadn't been laminated, but they were similar to all the other instructions Paul had made for Claire's benefit. She had found the list inside a folder in her desk that was labeled, "In Case of Emergency." He wanted to be buried in his family plot. He wanted a headstone that was similar in size and composition to the ones for his parents. He didn't want makeup or hair gel or to be embalmed or to have his body placed on view like a mannequin because he deplored the artifice surrounding death. He wanted Claire to pick out a nice suit for him and good shoes. Though what did it matter if he wore shoes, good or otherwise? And how would she know if they had put them on him anyway? Paul's last request on the list was the one that was the most heartbreaking. He wanted to be buried with his wedding ring and auburn class ring. Claire had been inconsolable, because she had wanted so badly to honor his wishes. But both rings had been taken by the Snake Man. Claire? Lydia was holding out the phone. She had already dialed in the number listed for Buckminster Fuller. Claire shook her head.
You do it.
Lydia turned on the speakerphone. The ringing sound filled the room, bouncing off the stark walls. Claire held her breath. She didn't know what she was expecting until the phone was answered. There was a clicking sound like an old answering machine whirring to life. The recording was scratchy, but the voice was unmistakably Paul's. He said,
"You have reached the Fuller residence. If you're looking for Buck..."
Claire put her hand to her throat. She knew what was coming next because their own voicemail message followed the same script. A chirpy woman's voice said,
"Or Lexi."
Paul finished,
"Please leave a message at the..."
A long beep blared from the burner phone speaker. Lydia ended the call.
"Lexi."
Claire nearly spat out the word. She sounded younger than Claire,
and happier,
and stupider, which should have been a consolation, but Claire was too consumed with jealousy to care. Claire stood up. She started pacing.
"Claire,
give me a minute.
You can't really be..."
"Shut up!"
Claire turned on her heel and walked back across the length of the room. She couldn't believe this. And then she chastised herself for not believing it because really, at this terrible point in her life, what difference did it make? Lydia pulled the iPad into her lap. She started typing again. Claire kept pacing from one side of the room to the other. She was well aware that her anger was misdirected, but she had proven on more than one occasion that her anger was fairly uncontrollable. Lydia said, "I'm not finding Alexi Fuller, Alex Fuller, Alexander Fuller, nothing in the county records." She kept typing. "I'll try in Madison, Oglethorpe."
"No."
Claire pressed her hand against the wall, wishing she could push down the house.
"What if we find her?
Then what?"
"We tell her that her husband's dead."
"Why do you keep wanting to dump my problems onto other people?"
"That's not fair."
Claire knew she was right, but she didn't care. "So, I knock on this Lexi's door and introduce myself, and if she doesn't tell me to fuck off, which is what I would do in her shoes, I tell her, 'Oh, by the way, in addition to Paul being a polygamist, he's a thief and probably a rapist and absolutely a stalker, and he got off on watching women being tortured and murdered.'" She pushed away from the wall and started pacing again.
"Trust me, she doesn't want to know."
"Wouldn't you want to know?"
"Absolutely not."
Claire was surprised by her decisiveness. She flashed back to the first time she'd sat in front of Paul's computer. Red pill, blue pill. If she could go back, would she choose to live in ignorance? Adam might have eventually told her about the stolen money, but the movies and files would have probably remained hidden. Would Claire have gone through the storage area in the basement? Paul was the one with an emotional attachment to silly love notes and the ticket stubs from the first movie they'd ever seen. She had already decided that she couldn't live in Paul's dream house without Paul. Claire would have probably moved to a smaller house, maybe a condo downtown. She could easily imagine her alternate self calling a shredding service to destroy everything, rather than pay to have it put into storage or moved. Lydia asked, "Was Paul away on business trips a lot?" She shook her head.
"Only for a few days at a time, and he usually took me with him.
Claire figured she might as well say what they had both thought when they saw the swing set in the front yard.
If he had a kid, then he's a really shitty father.
Lydia said, Watkinsville is less than 15 minutes from a campus filled with co-eds. She waited for Claire to turn around.
What if there are more folders? More women.
Claire's mind went to an even darker place.
Is there a basement in that house?
Lydia didn't move for several seconds. Finally, she started typing on the iPad again. Claire knelt down beside her. Lydia pulled up the tax records for the Watkinsville address. She traced her finger down the descriptions as she read, single-family home, wood siding, built in 1952, forced air heating, city water, septic system, no attic square feet, basement square feet, none. She looked at Claire. No basement. Claire slid back down to the floor. She stared out the windows. Sunlight bleached the already bleached room.
The masked man. That's not Paul. I know his body.
Is it Adam?
The question hit Claire like a punch to the heart. Adam was around the same height as the masked man. He also had the same light coloring. As far as the rest, she didn't know. Claire hadn't been in love with Adam Quinn. She hadn't spent hours lying beside him, touching and kissing his skin, memorizing his body.
We fucked 3 times. We never took off all of our clothes. It was always standing up.
How romantic.
Lydia put down the iPad.
You're sure that's Paul's voice on the answering machine?
Claire nodded, because Paul's soft southern drawl was unmistakable.
What should we do?
She amended.
I mean, what should I do?
Lydia didn't answer. She just stared out into the backyard, the same way Claire had done before. Claire joined her, absently watching a lone squirrel hop across the decking and drink saline water from the pool. Asking what to do next was a loaded question, because what it all boiled down to was whether or not Claire wanted to know more. This was past red pill, blue pill. This was skinning the proverbial onion. They both jumped when the phone rang. Claire checked the burner, but the screen was blank. Lydia said,
It's not my cell.
The phone rang a second time. Claire crawled toward the cordless handset on the table beside the couch. The phone rang again. She started to get that familiar, sick feeling even before she heard Fred Nolan's voice.
Claire, he said, glad I caught you.
His voice was as loud and clear as a church bell. Claire held the phone away from her ear so that Lydia could hear, too. He said,
I think I'm going to take you up on that offer to talk to you and your lawyer.
Claire's eardrums filled with the pounding of her own heartbeat.
When?
How about today?
It's Sunday.
She hadn't realized what day it was until now. Almost a full week had passed since Paul had been murdered.
Nolan said, I'm sure you've got enough money to pay the colonel's weekend rate.
The colonel. That was what they'd called Wynne Wallace, the lawyer who'd helped Claire get out of the assault charge. Paul had called him the colonel because he was the same type of arrogant prick as Jack Nicholson's character in A Few Good Men.
Claire?
How would Nolan know their private nickname? Had Paul used the colonel to get out of the embezzlement charges, too?
Hello?
She looked at Lydia, who was shaking her head so hard that she was probably going to give herself whiplash. Claire asked,
Where?
Nolan gave her the address.
I'll be there in 2 hours.
Claire ended the call. She put the receiver back in the cradle. When she took her hand away, she saw that her palm had left a sweaty mark. Lydia said. You're going to give him the files?
No, I'm not going downtown.
Claire stood up.
I'm going to Athens.
What? Lydia stood up too. She followed Claire into the mudroom. You just told Nolan you were... Fuck Nolan. Claire picked up her purse. She slid her feet into her tennis shoes. She didn't know why, but she had to see Lexi Fuller. She wasn't going to talk to her or drop a bomb on her life, but Claire needed to see the other woman with her own two eyes. She said, Listen, Lydia, I really appreciate... Shut up, I'm coming with you. Lydia disappeared into the house. Claire checked the mailbox on the video keypad by the door. The Auburn USB drive was still there. It was 9:13 on a Sunday morning. Was it a good or a bad thing that Adam Quinn was sleeping in? Or had he left the drive for someone else to pick up? Was Jacob Mayhew on his way? Would Fred Nolan consider Claire's absence in 2 hours a form of willfully misleading a federal agent? Would she return home tonight to her own bed, or would she be spending the next few years of her life in prison? Lydia returned with her purse. She had her iPhone in one hand and the burner in the other. I'm driving. Claire didn't argue because Lydia was older and she always got to drive. She opened the mudroom door and left it unlocked. At this point, Claire welcomed the burglars to return. She would have left cookies out for them if she'd had the time. Claire unplugged the Tesla. The key fob was on the bench where she'd left it. She threw it into her purse and got into the car. Lydia climbed in behind the wheel. She reached down and adjusted the seat. She moved the mirrors. She frowned at the glowing 17-inch touchscreen that ran down the middle of the dashboard. This is electric, right? Lydia sounded annoyed. She'd always been angry around new things. Athens is an hour away.
Really? I've never noticed that the 110 billion times I've driven this very same car to Mom's house and back.
At least she had before the ankle monitor limited her movements.
Can we just go?
Lydia still looked annoyed. Where does the key go?
Tap the brake to turn it on.
Lydia tapped the brake. Is it on?
I can't even hear it.
Are you 300 years old? Claire demanded. Jesus Christ, it's still a car. Even Grandma Jenny could figure it out. That was really mean. She put the gear in reverse. The video screen switched to the rear camera view. Lydia huffed in disgust as she inched back the car and turned it around. The gate was still open at the bottom of the driveway. Claire felt like 10 years had passed since she sat in the back of the limousine with her mother and grandmother. She tried to remember how she'd felt. The purity of her grief had been such a luxury. There was another woman in Watkinsville who might be feeling those same pure emotions of grief. Paul had been gone for almost a week. She would have called hospitals and police stations and the highway patrol and whoever else would listen. And she would be told by everyone who did even the slightest bit of research that Buckminster Fuller, the father of the geodesic dome, had died in 1983. Claire wondered what story Paul had given the woman to explain his absences. Traveling salesman, government agent, roughneck working an oil rig. Pilot. Paul had trained for his pilot's license in college. He was rated for light jets, which meant that whenever they hired a charter, he was always up in the cockpit talking tailwinds and altimeters with the pilots. Claire used to feel sorry for the poor men who were trying to keep the plane in the sky. Should she feel sorry for Lexi Fuller? And did she have a right to keep the other woman in the dark about Paul? Claire, of all people, knew the kind of hell that knowing the truth would rain down. Could she do that to another human being? Or maybe Lexi already knew about Claire.
Maybe the young little bitch was completely fine with sharing another woman's husband, with raising the man's bastard child, or children, while he kept another wife. Claire closed her eyes. What an awful thing to say about the other woman. She was turning Lexi into a monster when Paul had likely fooled them both. Even if Lexi was complicit in polygamy, there was no way she knew about the dreadful shit that Paul was into. Dyadic completion, Paul would have told Claire. The human brain tends to assume that if there's a victim, there has to be a villain. Was that how Claire was thinking of herself now? As just another one of Paul's victims? Claire? Lydia had relaxed her stranglehold on the steering wheel. I think we need more information. Just the thought made Claire cringe. What do you mean? The county's online records only go back 10 years. Has Paul always owned the house? Does that matter? I just wonder if there were other Mrs. Fullers. Claire stared at the road. The problem with being around Lydia was that she easily thought the worst of Paul. You think he buried them in the backyard? I didn't say that. You didn't have to. Claire leaned her head into her hand. She didn't want Lydia here, but she couldn't imagine doing this without her. She had forgotten how annoying it was to have a sister. Lydia signaled to merge onto the interstate. By way of an olive branch, she offered. Dad always hated driving on Sundays. Claire didn't want to, but she smiled. When her father was teaching her to drive, he'd warned her that Sunday was the most dangerous day to be on the road. He'd said that people were tired and grumpy from sitting in church for hours in scratchy clothes, and that they drove like bats out of hell when they were finally released. Lydia asked, "What were you doing at the McDonald's yesterday?" Claire told her the truth. "Wondering if it would be impolite to throw up in the bathroom without ordering something."
"I think they're used to it."
Lydia accelerated into the fast lane. For someone who had complained so much about the car, she seemed to be enjoying the ride.
"What do you think Nolan's going to do when you don't show up at his office?"
"I guess it depends. If what he's doing is legitimate, then he'll put out an APB on me. If it's not, then he'll start calling me again or go by the house."
"You left the garage door open. All he has to do is go inside and look at Paul's laptop."
"Let him."
Claire couldn't see the point of trying to hide the movies. She was the one who turned them over to the police in the first place.
"The same rules apply. If Nolan is there legitimately, then he'll have a search warrant. If he's not, then he can take the hard drive and shove it up his ass."
"Maybe he'll be there when Adam picks up the USB drive."
"Great. They can watch the movies and jerk off together."
Lydia didn't laugh.
"Can I ask you something?"
Claire studied her sister. She wasn't the type to ask for permission.
"What?"
"What do you do all day? Do you have a job or what?"
Claire sensed a loaded question. Lydia probably assumed she sat around all day eating bonbons and spending Paul's money. To be fair, sometimes she did, but other times Claire felt she made up for it.
"I volunteer a lot. The Humane Shelter, the food bank, the USO."
She might as well be making a list of all the things that were important to her father.
"I was helping at the Innocence Project for a while, but a case came through with Ben Carver's name on it."
Ben Carver had been one of two serial killers who had strung their father along.
"I took French and German to travel on. I still play the piano. I cut the grass if it needs it, and it's not too hot. I used to play tennis 3 or 4 hours a day, but for some reason no one will play with me anymore."
She asked Lydia,
What about you?
I work, I go home, I go to sleep. I get up and work again.
Claire nodded, as if she didn't know otherwise. You dating anybody?
Not really.
Claire darted around a slow-moving Mercedes.
Does Mom know you've talked to me?
She acted like the question was spontaneous, but the rawness in her voice gave her away. I didn't tell her, Claire admitted. But only because I was upset, and I knew if I called her, she would hear it in my voice and get the truth out of me.
What's the truth?
That you weren't lying, and that the fact that you weren't lying meant that Paul was. Which means that my 18-year marriage was complete and utter bullshit, and my husband was a psychopath. Lydia tucked her chin into her neck, but for once, she kept her mouth closed. Claire realized, I haven't apologized to you for what I did.
No, you haven't.
I'm sorry. She tried, but the two words seemed so small compared with the enormity of what she'd taken away. I should have believed you. Claire knew that wasn't quite right either. She couldn't imagine a scenario at that point in their lives where she might have trusted Lydia. Even if I didn't believe you, I should have never let you go. Lydia had her head turned away. She sniffed. Claire looked down at her sister's hand. She didn't know whether or not to touch her. I'm sorry, Pepper. I abandoned you. I made Mom abandon you.
You couldn't make Mom do anything she didn't want to do.
I'm not so sure about that. For the first time, Claire considered the full implications of what she had actually done. She hadn't just cut Lydia out of her own life. She had excised her from what was left of her family. Mom was terrified of losing another child. I knew that, and I worked it in my favor because I was so angry at you. I forced her into a Sophie's Choice. Claire thought this might be the only situation where that phrase was even mildly applicable. I was wrong. I'm so profoundly sorry for what I did to you. To our family.
Well.
Lydia wiped away tears.
I was pretty messed up back then. Everything you said was true. I stole from all of you. I lied all of the time.
But you never lied about something like that, and I should have seen it. Claire laughed at the gross understatement. Obviously, I didn't see a lot of things. Lydia's throat worked as she fought back more tears. Claire didn't know what else to say. That she was proud of her sister, for getting clean and pulling herself up from dire poverty. That her daughter was beautiful and accomplished and clearly amazing. That her boyfriend obviously worshipped her. Everything she knew about Lydia's life had come from Paul's private detectives. Which meant that, even though Claire had bared the dark, rotted soul of her marriage, Lydia still didn't trust her with the truth about her own life. So, Lydia was obviously ready to change the subject. She waved her hand at the touchscreen. Does this thing have a radio? It can play any song you want. Claire touched the media icon. Just say out loud what you want to hear and it'll find it on the internet and play it.
No way.
Welcome to the 1%. Claire split the display. She felt like the eager young kid at the Tesla dealership as she swiped through the different screens. You can read your email, see how much battery power you have left, go on the internet. Claire stopped. When she touched the internet icon,
The system reloaded the last page Paul had looked at. Feedly.com was a news aggregator that operated along the same lines as Google Alerts, but with news stories. Paul had entered only one name into the search engine. Lydia asked, "What's wrong?"
"Pull over."
"Why?"
"Pull over."
Lydia gave a heavy sigh, but she still did as Claire ordered. The rumble strips roared inside the car as they coasted to a stop on the side of the interstate. Lydia asked, "What's wrong?"
Paul set an alert for any news on Anna Kilpatrick. The last one came in 2 minutes ago.
Lydia grabbed her purse and pulled out her glasses. "What are you waiting for?" Claire tapped her finger on the most recent alert, a link from Channel 2, an Atlanta ABC affiliate. The top of the homepage showed a black box for streaming video. The red banner read, "Live, breaking news in the Anna Kilpatrick case." A spinning circle indicated the video was buffering. Claire turned up the sound. They both waited, eyes focused on the screen. The Tesla shook as a brown UPS truck drove by. Lydia said, "This is taking forever." Finally, the video loaded, but there wasn't much to see. Captain Mayhew was standing behind a podium. Congressman Johnny Jackson, never one to miss a media opportunity, was standing behind him, slightly to the right so that he'd still be in the camera frame. They were both looking at a closed door off to the side. There were flashes of light from the cameras and shuffling sounds as the reporters grew impatient. A voiceover explained, "We've been told that the parents arrived in the building 5 minutes ago." The reporter did a recap of the Kilpatrick disappearance, going back to the police finding the girl's car in the parking lot of Lenox Mall. Claire could remember doing press conferences with her family. Back then, there were really only three news stations, so the conferences were held in the small front lobby of the sheriff's station. Claire and Lydia were told to look devastated, but not too devastated. Helen had worried that Julia's abductor would see her last two daughters and want to take them, too. The sheriff had told them to address their comments to Julia because he adamantly believed she was out there in some run-down hotel, laughing at her parents making fools of themselves on the evening news. Lydia said, "Here they come." On the screen, the side door opened. Anna Kilpatrick's parents made their way up to the stage and stood on Mayhew's left. He nodded at them as if to say, "We'll get through this." They did not nod back. They both looked like death row inmates awaiting execution. Lydia said, "They found the body." Claire shushed her, but seconds later Mayhew confirmed her guess. He said, "The remains of a young woman were found at approximately 4 a.m. this morning on a jogging trail off the Beltline." The Beltline ran through Midtown. Claire had some friends who jokingly referred to it as the rape line because of the large number of sexual assaults that happened on the trail. Mayhew continued, "The DeKalb County Crime Lab was able to identify the remains based on photographs and fingerprints. The Kilpatricks confirmed the findings an hour ago." Claire asked, "They let them see the body? Wouldn't you want to?" Claire wasn't so sure anymore. Mayhew said, "At this moment, we have no additional leads. We would ask that anyone who recognizes the man from the sketch please call the hotline." He held up the police sketch of the man who'd been seen near Anna's car. "The Kilpatricks would like to thank everyone who helped search for..." Claire muted the sound, because she knew what was coming next. The reporters would ask questions. Mayhew would not give them answers. She watched Mayhew gesture to Bob Kilpatrick, Anna's father.
The man had the same weepy, broken expression that she had seen countless times on her father's face. Lydia had seen it, too.
He reminds me of Dad.
Claire forced herself to look away from Eleanor Kilpatrick. The woman was clinging to her husband like they were lost at sea. And they were lost. Even if they made it back to land, they would always be on unsteady ground. Lydia held Claire's hand. She felt the comfort of her sister's touch spread through her like warm water. They sat in the car, listening to trucks whir by. Would Claire want to see Julia's body? It would be different after all these years. There would just be bones. But the bones would mean so much because they would have something to bury, some place to leave their grief. What's happening? Lydia was not posing an existential question. She was pointing to the touchscreen. Eleanor Kilpatrick had pushed Mayhew out of the way. She gripped the microphone in her hand. Claire turned up the volume. Eleanor Kilpatrick's angry voice screeched from the speakers.
Was branded like a goddamn animal!
The feed was cut. The Channel 2 news anchor came on screen. We'd like to apologize to our viewers for the language you just heard.
Find the uncensored feed, Lydia ordered. Find it!
I'm looking. Claire had already pulled up the search page. The news feed had updated again. There were a dozen more sites carrying the press conference. Claire picked the sketchiest one. The rainbow wheel in the center of the screen started to spin. Lydia said, "Try another one."
"Give it time."
Claire gripped her hands together so she wouldn't grab the screen. She was about to give up when the page finally loaded. Mayhew was frozen, the microphone in front of him. Jackson stared straight ahead like a good soldier. Claire pressed the play button. He said, "The remains of a young woman." "It's at the beginning." Lydia had obviously been paying attention. She scrubbed her finger along the bottom of the video until it got to Eleanor Kilpatrick's outburst.
"This is bullshit!"
the woman screamed. Johnny Jackson skillfully stepped out of the frame, leaving the damage control to Jacob Mayhew.
"Mrs. Kilpatrick." Mayhew covered the mic with his hand.
"No!"
Eleanor Kilpatrick tried to push away his hand. She was a small woman. She couldn't move him, so she turned to the reporters and yelled,
"My daughter was cut up!"
They responded with a strobe of flashing lights. Mayhew repeated, "Mrs. Kilpatrick." She grabbed the mic away from him.
"Her breasts were mutilated. She was branded like a goddamn animal!"
Mayhew tried to get the mic. She jerked away from him. He tried again, but Bob Kilpatrick sucker-punched him in the stomach.
"She was our baby!"
Eleanor cried.
"She was just a child!"
Two uniformed cops pinned down Bob Kilpatrick. His wife kept screaming, even as he was dragged away.
"What kind of animal would do that to our little girl? What kind of animal?"
Mayhew wiped his mouth with the back of his hand. He was clearly furious. In front of all the reporters, he grabbed Eleanor Kilpatrick around the waist and carried her across the stage. The mic dropped when it ran out of cord. Mayhew practically threw the woman through the open doorway. The door slammed closed. The camera stayed on it for a few seconds before cutting to black. Both Claire and Lydia stared at the screen. Lydia asked,
"Did you see what she did?"
"Yes."
Claire reloaded the page. They waited for the video to load. Instead of skipping forward, she played the press conference from the beginning. First Mayhew, then Eleanor Kilpatrick. As soon as the video finished, she reloaded the page so they could watch the news conference a third time. The reporter's voiceover. Mayhew at the podium. The Kilpatricks entering the room. Neither Claire nor Lydia could stop watching. They were both
transfixed by Eleanor Kilpatrick's outburst, the way she traced an X on her belly when she said her daughter had been branded. Claire paused the video. Eleanor Kilpatrick froze on the screen. Her mouth gaped open. She had her right hand pressed to the left side of her belly, slightly off-center, just below her ribs. Lydia said, "Her breasts were mutilated."
"I know."
"Her stomach was branded with an X."
"I know."
Exactly like the second girl in Paul's movies. The one who looked like Anna Kilpatrick. Part 4.
"Do you remember that article you wrote for the school newspaper when Timothy McCorkadale was executed? He was sentenced to death in the 1970s for murdering a white girl he'd seen talking to a black man in a midtown Atlanta bar. You were hard-pressed to understand why a white girl talking to a black man engendered so much rage. I was both proud and hopeful that you didn't understand this incipient sort of racism. Your mother and I grew up during the last gasps of Jim Crow. We marched for equal rights. But that was easy to do when all of our friends and fellow students were marching right alongside us. I remember talking to your mother about your article, in which you editorialized that while McCorkadale deserved to be punished, society did not have the right to put him to death. We were so proud of you for believing the things that we believed. We, too, shared your outrage at the thought of a man being electrocuted for kidnapping, raping, torturing, and eventually murdering a 17-year-old girl. I was thinking about your article this morning when I drove to the Georgia Diagnostic and Classification Prison. You might recall from your research on your story that this is the location of Georgia's death row. I'm not sure why your article came into my mind as I drove through the front gate, and while I am still proud of you, I have, understandably, changed my mind about the death penalty. The only reservation I have now is that I feel the parents should be given the option of flipping the switch. A few years after you disappeared, a postal worker named Ben Carver was sentenced to death for murdering 6 young men. He is a homosexual, which, according to Huckleberry, means he is not attracted to murdering young women. Rumors have it that Carver cannibalized some of his victims, but there was never a trial, so the more salacious details were not made public. I found Carver's name in the sheriff's file 10 months ago, the 5th anniversary of your disappearance. The letter was written on Georgia Department of Corrections stationery and signed by the warden. He was informing the sheriff that Ben Carver, a death row inmate, had mentioned to one of the prison guards that he might have some information pertaining to your disappearance. Huckleberry made a note that he followed up on the lead, but Carver told me himself that the sheriff never paid him a visit. Of course I visited Ben Carver. In fact, I have been to the prison a total of 48 times in the last 10 months. I would visit him more, but death row inmates are only allowed visits once a week. Sweetheart, I am sorry I haven't told you about the visits until now, but please keep reading and maybe you will understand why. On visiting day, Ben Carver and I sit across from each other like fish in a tank separated by a wire mesh between us. There are tiny holes in the mesh. The visiting room is loud. There are roughly 80 men on death row, and for many of them, their only contact with the outside world is their mothers. You can imagine that much emotion is on display. Ben Carver's mother is too elderly to visit him anymore, so it's just me he sees. I have to bend down and put my lips close to the metal, even though I can see the black grime from where thousands of mouths have been before mine. AIDS, I think. hepatitis B, herpes, influenza, mononucleosis, and still I put my mouth to the screen. Carver is a charming man with a soft voice. He is courteous and attentive, which I wonder about because is this his natural disposition or has he read too many novels about Hannibal Lecter? Regardless, he always expresses great concern for my well-being. "You look tired today," he'll say, or "Are you eating enough?" Or "You might want to talk to your barber about your hair." I know he flirts with me because he is lonely, just as I flirt back because I want to know what he knows. So, we talk about everything but you. He has almost perfect recall for movie dialogue. Casablanca, Gone with the Wind, Midnight Cowboy, Monty Python. Then there are the books he's read. Most of the classics. Ann River Siddons for The Atlanta Connection. Barbara Cartland for romance. Neil Gaiman for fantasy. I have had more conversations about the Celestine Prophecy than I care to mention. I do not tell your mother about these conversations, and not just because she thinks the Bridges of Madison County is sentimental tripe. She has held firm to her refusal to hear about what I call my extracurricular activities, and what she calls my fruitless quest. Absent this subject, there is very little for us to talk about anymore. We can only rehash for so long old memories of agonizing camping trips and tooth fairy adventures and heated parent-teacher conferences. Your sisters have started their own lives. They have found their own friends, started to build their own families outside of us. Your mother has my inferior replacement, and I have... Can I admit to you that I'm lonely? That every morning I wake up to a sparse, empty bedroom and stare up at a yellow popcorn ceiling and wonder if it's worth it to get out of bed. That I can't bear the thought of seeing my toothbrush standing alone without your mother's. That I have 2 plates, 2 spoons, 2 forks, and 2 knives. Not because I need that many, but because I could only find them in pairs. That I have lost my job. That I have finally lost your mother. That I have stopped asking your sisters to visit because every conversation feels like I am dragging them down underneath the ocean. So maybe you can understand why discussing movies and literature with a convicted serial killer became such an important part of my life. Here is a reason to bathe. Here is a reason to put on shoes. Here is a reason to leave the house, drive the car, go somewhere else other than my one-bedroom apartment that feels as much like a prison cell as anything you could find at the Georgia Diagnostic and Classification Prison. I know Ben is stringing me along, just like I know that I am letting myself be strung. It baffles me that the only times lately that I don't think about you are the times I am debating Joyce with a likely cannibal. Isn't the point of my visits to find out what Carver knows? To track down whatever rumor he has heard so that I can finally know what happened to you? But I have this nagging feeling that he knows nothing about you. And I have an even deeper nagging feeling that I do not care. So this is what I do. I tell myself I am studying him. Is this the sort of man who took you? Was your abductor as kind to you in the beginning as Ben Carver is kind to me? Did he take you because he wanted you all to himself? Or did he take you because he wanted to hurt you? Then I ask myself, what would happen if that grimy metal mesh were taken away? What would a man like Ben Carver do to me if there were no guards posted, no barrier between us. Would he explicate Spencer's Fairy Queen, or would he cut me open and sample a sliver of my pancreas?